You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Mary Alice Stevens. Mary and I chat about a choice she made when she was 45 years old to get sober and to stop drinking alcohol. So sobriety, in my opinion and my experience, I feel like it's a topic that has a lot more visibility than it used to. I really can't say whether that's just my perception or something that's actually happening. But it is also, I think, a deeply personal topic, a personal decision, and every story is unique. Mary and I talk about how her opinions and beliefs around alcohol and her behaviors formed and what she enjoyed about drinking. We also talk about what brought the decision to stop drinking to the surface for her and how her life has changed since she stopped. Mary is a great storyteller, and I think you are really going to enjoy this. So let's get started. Welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting, Mary Alice Stevens. Are you ready for a fun chat today?
Absolutely.
Yay. All right. I always start with the very, very same question. What part of the world do you call home?
Marin County, California.
Oh, one of my favorite places on the planet. Lucky you.
Yeah, thank you.
That is so good. All right. Next warm up question. So the audience is watching and listening to this episode in January 2026. I think that's sometimes for some people a season of planning. One thing that people really like to do sometimes is buy a new planner to get themselves organized. When you are planning a new project, are you a person who likes to use a paper planner, an online tool, a big wall calendar, or are you not somebody who does that at all?
I double down. I used to be a producer for my career, so I'm all about the planning. I use my app on my phone for my calendar, but then I print the week out the Sunday leading into the week, and I put the print out on my kitchen counter, and I make any little last minute changes there, and then I keep those like a journal.
Oh, you do, for a
I do.
record, in case you have
I
to go back and
binder clip
check.
them at the end of the year. That's how I wrote my book. I just remember all those little things and I file them away. And yeah, I'm all about the planning.
Love it. What a great answer. All right. Very good. In this conversation today, you and I are going to talk about alcohol, and we are going to talk about how you made the decision to get sober. So this is something that I think that you have probably talked about a lot in your life. I know that you've written a book about your story. Are you ready to have this conversation with me today?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Yay, let's do it. So let's start here. In the information I have in the pitch that you gave, you described yourself as a 45-year-old alcoholic housewife. That is super direct and clear. I got to say, there was no question about that. My question is, how old were you, if you remember, when you had your first drink or discovered drinking?
Drinking was a big part of the fabric of my family. We were American, Irish, Catholic. And drinking was always how we celebrated everything. So moderate drinking, but my father would always mix up cocktails for all the holidays, birthdays, special occasions, and just on the weekend. So I was his bartender's assistant from when I was tiny, you know, helping him stir the drinks, putting the olives in the martinis, serving the drinks. And then my first drink was in eighth grade. I went to a party out at a farm, and we got into the beer that was kept out in the mudroom. And out of the gate, it was trouble for me. I was like, "Woo, this is exciting!" And then I went out and thought I was chasing a cow around a pen, and it turned out to be a bull. And the bull started looking at me like, "What are you doing here?" And I was like, "Ah!" So I ran and like ripped my new purple cords, and
So eighth grade.
Then I took a break until I was about 16, and then it was off to the races.
Oh, okay. All right. So eighth grade was exposure, and then there was a break, and so we go. So you started this already. I want to talk a little bit about your family and your community growing up. So you had a social, your family had a social culture of drinking. It's something you grew up around. And was there also any family culture of like, were there members of the family? And you don't have to give any details because I want to be careful to not have you wrap people up. But did you have any childhood exposure to like adults getting into trouble or any problems with drinking when you were growing up?
We do have the gene in my family, but my uncle was long sober. So all I knew was people were very careful to keep booze away from him at the dinner table. My sister had gotten sober when she was 29, but she lived in Boston on the other side of the country and she was 12 years older than me. So I didn't have experience of drunks,
Okay.
just far off sober people, and then a history of like I knew of other family members, but they had passed on by the time I was aware.
So sort of like family lore, you knew that it was
Yeah.
out there. And like, and the purpose of the question is not to throw family members or the family group under the bus or anything, but just, you know, awareness of what existed in like various things. And then, so you start when you're in eighth grade and then 16. In your like high school society, your community and culture, like high school, college, young adult life, was your social life, as many folks are, especially in the working community, like the corporate work world, it was your social life sort of focused around drinking events?
Absolutely. From high school, I wanted to be in with the cool crowd and they drank, so I drank. It kind of got rid of my social anxiety. And I felt really comfortable in my own skin when I was had some alcohol in it. Same in college, same in my career, television and advertising. That was a big party culture, work hard, play hard, kind of culture. There were people who didn't, but I wasn't one of those people. I was all in.
I love that you mentioned advertising, which just makes me, was not part of the interview or anything based in reality, but reminds me of the show Mad Men,
I was just
where
thinking
like,
that too. I
which
had a
is,
bar like in my living room. My bar looked like a Mad Men set, and I
yeah.
was so proud of it.
There you go. And was that at home or was it the office?
At home.
At home. All right. So very, because in Mad Men, it's like in the office. It's like one of those crazy things, like everywhere. I've never actually worked in an environment where there was the like three martini lunch or anything. So that to me is like, yeah. So it,
Guilty.
I've heard of it, and I've heard people my own age who've talked about it. And I'm like, I just missed it. I don't know if, where was I? That sounds like that was a great time.
It was a
So
great time while you were doing it, and then the afternoon was the worst, longest
that's.
rest of your day.
Crawl under the desk, take a nap. I once went in a different story, but I once had a coworker. I went into her office and I couldn't find her. And she was under the desk taking a nap. She was pregnant. She was in the first trimester of being pregnant, and she had gotten so sleepy that she crawled under the desk. And I was like, "What is happening? Where are you?"
I used to sleep on Friday mornings at 8 a.m. I had the job of posting a show that I was on, which meant I had to sit in a dark room for 8 hours with the editor and supervise the edit. And I would crawl under the edit desk and sleep off the night before.
Oh my, wow, you know, dark room, dark
Yeah.
room. I once had to change a class because it was art history class early in the morning. And you'd go in, the room was dark early in the morning, and they'd show the pretty slides, talk about it. And I was like, I was instantaneously, I
Night
was like,
night.
I was like, I need the afternoon version of this class. All right. So when and how do you think that you first became aware that drinking alcohol for you was creating a problem?
Gosh, early on, but the pros outweighed the cons for me. Like I was so having so much fun that it was worth the hangovers for a while. I
Okay.
had terrible hangovers, and I wouldn't say I did stupid stuff on a regular basis when I was drunk, but I definitely put myself in risky situations. And when I was in Ireland, when I was 23, I was going to grad school there at Trinity. I was trying to go to a party. I was three drinks in, and these guys were like, "I know how to jump over this wall to get on campus." And I'm like, "I'll do that." And didn't focus on where they jumped, and I fell three stories and broke my back in three places and crushed my heel and went up in the hospital, body cast. I'm still having ankle surgeries because of that. So a lot of really dumb consequences from drinking. However,
So you were
because I never had,
23 when you did
yeah,
that. That's a pretty serious fall.
Very serious. And I was in denial. I'm like, that didn't have anything to do with drinking. That was 3 drinks was nothing to me at that point, you know? But I was just in denial because I didn't want to quit drinking.
Did people, when you were 20, so when you were 23 and you were in that situation, did people who were in your social circle or your support circle, your family, your parents, did they bring up the concept that alcohol might be related to making this decision, or was it just your internal line of thought?
No, I mean, I was only 7 weeks into my year abroad, so I didn't really have close friends yet over
Okay.
there. And there was no way in hell I was telling anybody back home the truth, you know? So I didn't have anybody else sit me down about my drinking until I was 45 and married and had 2 little kids, and that was my husband. But other than
Okay.
that, I think because I surrounded myself with drinkers and I was a happy drunk, and I was high functioning, it didn't interfere with my work, that I kind of really kept it hidden.
Okay. Yeah. So this was an internal dialogue that you had going on. So I've had a couple other conversations with guests about sobriety and recovery, even though it's not something I'm an expert in. I just want to loop in anybody who's watching and listening that doesn't maybe know some of the terms you just used. When we talk about, when you say you were a happy drunk, what would be the alternative and what do you mean when you say that?
Sometimes people cry easily, or they get mad, they rage, they pick fights, they break things, they get what's the word? Not melancholy, but like maudlin. That's the word.
Yeah, maudlin, sure. Yeah. And so, and then why do you think that being a happy drunk enabled you to keep going and not face this earlier?
Because it didn't hurt my friendships or my relationships. You
Yeah.
know, I think when somebody's screaming at you when you're drunk, that's the person you're going to talk to the next day and say, "Hey, that was out of control. I think you have a problem."
Yeah, earlier this year I read something. I saw a video online. I don't even know if this is a real term. It was Chardonnay rage, and I was like, that's a funny, it's a funny pairing of words there.
If you watch
So
any Real Housewives episode, you'll see what we're talking
there
about.
you go, there you go. I had somebody ask me. So I live in Miami, Florida, and somebody asked me this week. They were like, "Do you know any of the Real Housewives of Miami?" I was like, "Well, I could be a Real Housewife in that I am a person with a house. I have a wife. I am in Miami, but no, that's it. That I don't run in those same circles." All right. So those are the things that were going on in your life. And so the first time you were doing some risky things, but you say the pros outweighed the cons. And the cons you mentioned so far are hangovers, which I think everybody knows what those are, and then some risky decisions you made. What were the pros that kept you going?
Drinking made me feel connected to other people, connected to a part of myself that was not self-critical. For some reason, when I drank, all the negativity in my head went away and I felt prettier and funnier and flirtier. You know, it brought out all the qualities in me that I liked. I had all of my fun kind of surrounded drinking. Like I was very extroverted. I loved going out, especially when I was young, dancing, going to bars, playing pool, all that stuff I did better drinking. Flirting, you know, going out on dates. Like, how do you go on a date without drinking? I never had a sober date until I quit drinking.
All right.
And I just didn't think it would be possible to have fun without it. And then also, I had some bad things happen. Like, my brother died very unexpectedly when I was 30, and I was very close to him. And drinking was my way of connecting with him because we used to drink together. Totally unhealthy way of connecting with him, but that was my go-to solution. Then I had a first marriage that was kind of a disaster, and I was lonely in the marriage, drank through that, started drinking wine at home. That was a shift, you know, and then drank after that when I was like, oh, I can't be alone. I feel too sad. I'm just going to go out every night after work and have a couple drinks until I can just go home and go to bed.
I hear you. I hear you. When you think of the younger version of you, like the middle school version of you, do you think you were aware that, wait, well, it's bad. This is a terrible question because you're not that person anymore. But looking back as an adult, were you at all aware of any of the social anxiety and pressure to fit in and any of those things at that age?
I felt less than. I just, for some reason, I felt like everybody was cooler than I was, had an easier life than I did. When I say easier, I just mean like I was the sixth of seven kids, and my
I
parents
was
were
going to
like,
ask you that when you said you had a 10-year-old sibling, an older sibling 10 years older than you. I was like, that there's a question there. Like how many,
Yeah. So we just had super strict parents, no TV, 3-minute phone limit, lots of chores, no going out on school nights unless it was for sports. And I felt like everybody else were like, oh, there's two kids in my family. We have money and we get to watch TV and have a phone in my bedroom. And I don't know. I think I kind of grew up with a chip on my shoulder and that never went away. And drinking removed that feeling.
So, through an adult lens, which this is again, this is a crappy, crappy question, but it's one of the things that I think about all the time. When you look back, do you think that was perception that kids had a different experience, an easier experience around you? Like that was just the way you were seeing it? Or was it an accurate reflection of the community of kids that were around that you did have, in some ways, more challenges?
I know what the right answer is, but I'm going to go with the real
No,
answer
go with the
was
real answer.
I think they had it easier than I did.
That's fair. I think that's totally fair. I think that it's one of the interesting things about growing up and looking back at your own experience growing up, because sometimes there's a rewriting of what it was really like. So if you go back to like a kindergarten classroom and you have to face the fact that the chairs are so small, but you remember the room being really big, it's like that's a rewriting. And so that definitely happens. But sometimes you look back and you're like, no, this actually was really hard. Like, or
Well,
there
and
was a big difference.
the reason it was hard was because it was a disconnection. They all had so much in common. They were watching Happy Days and talking about it at school the next day, and I couldn't. They were getting to go out after school and go to 7-Eleven and wander around and bond. You know, they had all these bonding opportunities. They also had two working parents, so they were latchkey kids, we called it back then. My mom was home all the time, and I had to have perfect grades, be home, be helpful. So it was a disconnection, and that feeling of disconnection has been a theme throughout my life. And I think that's where alcohol was that easy solution, to come in.
Finding community, finding alliance. I think that's really good. There's one of the kids in my family this is around a more modern, you mentioned watching TV and communicating and socializing around that common experience. One of the kids in my family was like, everybody I know has Instagram. And I was like, nah, that's not possible. And so I showed up in the room and asked all these little kids, and they were like, oh, yeah. And I left and I walked away. I was like, okay, they all do. All right. I was wrong. My
Yeah.
assumption was wrong. They all do. You are the only one that didn't have it. I was wrong. Okay. I was so wrong. It was so funny. All right. So one of the things, and you've started this a little bit, like, so one of the things you mentioned when your description of your situation is that you were 45 and you thought that you did not have it in you to quit alcohol, and that you loathed, strong word, the idea of a future without alcohol. So those are the words that you wrote. So I want to ask if you remember from back then when you were 45, because it wasn't just yesterday, what were the ideas that you were holding in your head at that time about quitting? Like, what were the things bouncing around that made you think that you were not a person who would be able to do this, and unable to imagine a future without it?
I didn't know how to socialize without it, and I was very social. I had kind of gone from a professional to a stay-at-home mom. I moved to Marin, and all of my new mom friends, I kind of plucked out the ones who liked to drink like I did. And I just didn't know how to go through that socializing without it. It seemed like torture because everybody else would still be drinking except me. And to watch them kind of have that ease and comfort of a few drinks and the laughing and the camaraderie, it kind of hit that sore spot again of disconnection. And also at home, I was just so used to it was Pavlovian, 5 o'clock, just pour myself a glass of wine while I made dinner, have a glass with dinner, have one after the kids went to bed. Everything I did was better, air quotes, with alcohol, like taking a hot tub, going on a walk, everything.
Yeah. So I think that's really interesting that you call out that you had moved and you had selected a social circle that had similar hobbies to you. And the reason I think it's interesting is just because that is something that in another conversation we would say was a success tip, right? If you wanted to run a marathon, we would say go find people who are doing the thing that you want to do and surround yourself with them. And I think it's a really interesting thing that the same sort of strategy can be used, can be helpful. I mean, if you wanted to drink a lot, it would be a helpful tip, right? It would be a helpful tip. So, and I also think it's interesting that you were aware that you had done that. Although I guess maybe not, maybe it just is natural, like to like, it's like, oh, I want to find the moms that play pickleball, or I want to find the moms that play bridge. And so you found the moms that were doing happy hour. And what were some of the other, so you had young kids. So was it really just kind of happy hour and play dates or, and brunches, or what were the things that were pulling this
Well, and you
together?
know, all those kids have birthdays and all those birthday parties, 3-year-old birthday parties, all the moms were drinking wine at the parties. I mean, I served champagne at my son's 5th birthday party. It's so ridiculous when you think about it, right? But I also kind of think like motherhood is hard, and
Motherhood is hard.
it's a bonding experience when you connect with other moms and throw a glass of wine into it, and everyone becomes more vulnerable and open because it lowers your inhibition. So you're really sharing how hard it is, and that's comforting to know you're not alone. So you see what I mean, how
I
it.
do hear what you're saying. I will say there was one time at a soccer game, some kids' soccer game, and we had all the water, reusable coolers with water bottles, and mine had water in it. One of my kids ran over and took my insulated cup and took a sip of it, and so one of the other kids tried to do that to their parents, and she was like, no, you can't have mine. And I was like, what in the world? It's like 10 in the morning. I was like, what is in your, like, so it had never occurred to me to put anything other than water for mine, not as a virtuous thing, but as a cleaning thing. I was like, mine only ever have water in them because I don't want to wash the bottles and the straw. I never put juice or soda or anything, but
Yeah, it was a poorly hidden fact that at all those little baseball games and all those sports that the parents in their disguised cup like this had the whole cocktail.
exactly. I was completely unaware that that was what happened, and I have no judgment. I just was like, I never put anything in because cleaning the bottles when they just have water in them for me is easier. Like for me, it's a very pragmatic. I don't want to deal with a straw that has to be, soaked in anything. So, all right. So very good. So I have asked this question when I talk to other people about recovery journeys, and so I'll ask it to you because it's part of the sort of lore and canon of recovery and substance things. Do you think that you ever hit a singular low point or bottom that pushed you into choosing sobriety, or was it a gentle, slow choice?
It was an absolute moment for me. And it won't read like I hit rock bottom, but if for me it was my emotional bottom. I was pretty careful to keep my drinking away from the kids, waited till they were asleep, or we would go out and I'd get a babysitter. But the last day that I drank, we were at a daytime pool party, and I got blackout drunk in front of the kids. And it was time for us to go home, and I was. I didn't want to leave, and my husband was having to like, come on. And I was like, you put the kids in the car and I'll be right there. I'll get the stuff from the kitchen. And I shotgunned a glass of wine, like
Just
super
super
fast
fast.
because I just couldn't bear the thought of the hour drive home without anything more to drink. I just wanted to still have fun. And that rattled me. And then I blacked out after that. I woke up the next morning. I didn't know who fed the kids or bathed them or put them to bed. And then I realized like I was that person in front of them. I don't even know what I was doing. And my husband wasn't in bed next to me for the first time. And I just said, this is not okay. This is out of control. There were a couple of other times that I had put my kids' safety at risk already. And I thought to myself, like, I have to stop before something tragic happens. I just had this fear, like we have a swimming pool, and my worst fear was, drowning is a silent death. And I thought, this is it. This is my wake-up call. I have to quit. And then I said a quick prayer, like, God, please help me quit drinking. And that was the last time I drank. So that was 14 years ago.
All right, so and you may be able to have this conversation yourself, like, or did you involve your husband
No,
and
it was all internal because I had never admitted to him I had a problem before because I didn't want to fix the problem. And I felt like if I was honest about it, he would give me an ultimatum or something, you know?
Okay. And so just as a pragmatic question, not for people who might be listening who are in a similar situation or thinking it through for themselves, because it is something that has a lot more face time and visibility in 2025, 2026 than it probably did in 1980. Like did you just make this shift and do this on your own, or did you have conversations with your family and use one of the many programs that's out there for help in making this change?
I had a friend who was 4 years sober and used AA. And that morning, after I told my husband, I went straight to an AA meeting because I am so social and I do like to be connected, that I knew I needed to feel in community to do this. So I, out of the gate, just she and I called my friend and she's like, "Do you want me to go with you?" And I said, "Sure."
Okay. I will say that that is, and this is not something I'm an expert in, but that is a common thread in several of the stories that I've had about this, that they reach out to somebody who's walked the path before and then they follow the instructions. And people have strong feelings about various recovery programs, plus and minus. And all I will say is that the good thing is there's a variety of them. It's like blood pressure medicine. It's like pick the one that works for you and create the life
Especially
you want.
now with Facebook and Instagram, there's so many social sober communities that you don't even have to stop drinking before you start exploring on your own privately. Like you could just
Yeah.
be on your phone secretly being sober curious and learning about alcoholism. There was so much to the disease or disorder, whatever you want to call it, that I didn't understand. And it was like an aha moment every page of the AA book or whatever. I was like, oh, compulsion, that phenomenon of craving, the obsession. I was always thinking about drinking. All the things that are going on inside between your two
Yeah.
ears, that's where all the alcoholism is, not so much as a litmus test of how much you've drank, because there can
Yeah.
be heavy drinkers who know how to turn it off and when it's appropriate or whatever. And then there's people like me who the first thing I think about used to be, how do I feel? Am I hungover? Okay, what did I drink last night? How much do I think I can drink today? Maybe I don't have to drink today. And then, like, the closer 5 o'clock got, do I have Chardonnay in the house? I'm fine. I'm fine. I just overreacted. I'll get it right this time. All that noise is part of the disease.
Yeah, well, and you use the word noise, which is what we use to describe it now. They talk about it with food noise, with drinking noise, with social anxiety noise. And I think that it's if you experience it and you've experienced the noise, the mental noise, the chatter in the head, I think it's a very, very good description. And then on the flip side, for people who've never experienced it, I think it's very hard to understand.
Yeah,
I
for
think it's
sure.
very hard to understand. And the reason I think that is that there's been this huge conversation about the food noise that has been, is removed when people take the GLP-1 drugs, it goes away. And yet there's like decades and decades of medical professionals who just did not listen, had never experienced it, didn't think it was a real thing. So it's a real reckoning of, oh, this is part of this process. So here's an off-the-wall question that you can just tell me to buzz off if it doesn't fit. Based on your experience going through this, do you happen to have an opinion on whether or not you think the pressures and the reality around drinking, drinking culture, and getting sober might be different for women versus men?
I think there's a double standard of being a drunk mom versus a drunk dad.
Okay, say more.
I think that women are held to a higher standard of parenting for sure. I also think moms have a higher level of parenting stress on the
Yeah.
whole. I don't want to generalize, but I just did. I think men can kind of. It's just more accepted for the guys. I don't think it's healthy for either parent to be consuming alcohol in an unsafe way, especially around the kids, but Does that answer your question?
I think it does. I think that, I think that in 2025, when we're recording this, we would like to believe that, there's no separation between the gender roles in a family with children, but that there's often default parents, one parent who's doing a lot of the work, and frequently that's the woman. And that it is very hard. And the reality of raising modern children is that it's often very isolating and stressful. For the person who's doing it, it's not happening in a community where you're surrounded by aunts and uncles and neighbors in close
Right.
quarters. It's in a house, a lot of pressure on one person. And I think that those strains are there. And that I think that what you're saying is that it's seen as fun and okay for dad to be drinking at the barbecue, at the grill,
Blowing off
and
steam.
blowing off steam, and there's a different lens that is put on women for, wine o'clock. And so I think that
There's
and that's the
also
reason I asked.
a lot of marketing around women drinking. Like you said, wine o'clock and rosé all day, and
A rosé all day. That's a very the person who came up with that is a cute marketing person. It's a cute slogan.
yeah,
It
book
is.
clubs,
Oh,
there's
yes.
just so many girl getaways.
Yep.
Guys don't seem to have getaways like girls do, but
No, and it is. I mean, it's one of those things about culture that you don't realize until somebody shows it to you. It's like, when the waitress comes up to the table and says, "What do you want to drink?" The answer, if you answer water, they're like, "Anything else?" And it's like, "No, that is a drink.
yeah,
Water
and
is a
it's
drink."
not even like that. It's can I get you started with a glass of wine or a cocktail?
It's definitely it's a different
If that's where they
thing.
make their money.
Sure, and they should make money. Exactly. Okay, so you've written a whole memoir about this, and you mentioned that you had the planner that you kept track of all of these things, and that was how you were able to do that. It's so funny. I write in a journal, and then when it's full, I throw it away. So I'm exactly the opposite. Like,
Wow.
I never look at it again. And I love the
Sacrilege.
idea. I know. I love that you bind it and you keep it. So you've got all these documentations. When you were going through and you were writing the book, and when you look back, what would you say is the very, very first choice, like that you made that moved you towards sobriety?
I mean, quitting drinking.
So was it actually, it was like you woke up and I was like, I'm done. Or
It
was there
was.
another one in there that was like, I'm gonna call my friend and tell her that I'm struggling?
No,
It was that I'm gonna quit.
I held so tight to not wanting to quit that I was like a horse with blinders on. I was disappointed. I had a lot of shame, but I kept it all to myself. I guess you're right. I guess toward the end, there was that one friend who was sober who I knew I could call and just kind of lament about, how bad I felt like it was getting. But it wasn't until that day, and that day surprised me. I was like, really? Is this the day that I'm quitting?
What do you think was different about that day versus all the other days?
It was the first time that I thought quitting would bring relief.
That is such a big distinction. That is such a, because, and the reason that stands out to me so much is that, when we talk about like motivation and making decisions, there's a piece of it. It's like, are you moving away from something or are you moving towards something? And this was the day that you had something to move towards that was relief.
That's right. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. I just realized how exhausting it was trying to manage my drinking, and I was failing miserably, and it was really hard to parent hungover, and I was, eroding the trust in my marriage. And I didn't want to be one of those one-armed, red-faced, drunken moms that you see at the parties, and you're like, oh, she's on a bender again. I wanted more for that from my life than that.
And we do the mom circle and the judgment that we put on moms inside the mom circle, it's fierce. It's fierce.
Yeah.
And so all the love for the red-faced moms in the room, like, we love you, we do. All right. So I am totally not a recovery coach or a therapist, but I do think that it's interesting how complicated this situation is with food and alcohol and even other situations. Because if you like drive down deep enough, right, no one is deciding to put something in your body other than ourselves, right? We're the only person who does that. But it's not like you can give up hydration. You have to put fluid in your body. So it's like not just one decision, it's a decision you're making hundreds of times a day. Like, what am I going to put in my body? What am I going to drink? And so, but then when we think about the conversation, right, we're distilling it down to one choice. None of that is a question, but here's a question. Okay. If my notes are correct, you made this choice in 2011. And so then the question is, how often or in what ways do you think about drinking today?
I don't ever think that I want to drink. I'm lucky that way. Alcohol is still all over my life. 99% of my friends still drink. My husband drinks moderately. My family drinks. So it's present, but it doesn't feel threatening anymore.
Okay.
It's just there.
Did it take a while to get to that point?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I drank for 30 years and held it on such a high pedestal that it was like a visceral reaction. You try to go to the grocery store and there's that floor to ceiling display of wine
Yeah.
the whole way down. I would be like, it was like seeing an ex-boyfriend. I would just have to like go the other entrance to the grocery store. And
Yeah.
my mouth would water when I would see somebody drinking Chardonnay on a summer day. It just watered.
Oh, so that
Water.
is really interesting because you have such a positive reflection. When you go to a barbecue or a party now, and people are there, what is going to be in your hand as a beverage? What do you choose today?
I am super into elderflower tonic these
Oh,
days.
really?
Yeah, it's got a bite to it, like a
Yeah.
cocktail does without any of the alcohol, because I don't like things that are too sweet, although I guess one could argue that that's pretty darn sweet. But I like something sparkling.
Yeah.
I'm still super into stemmed glassware. Like, I
Yeah.
will, when I order at a restaurant, I'll say, can I have a cranberry juice and club soda with a lime on the rocks in a big wine glass? And they're
That's
looking
very
at
cute.
me. And I'm like, yeah, I try to say a stemmed glass to take the word wine out of it. And they'll look at me and I said, wine glass. And they're like, oh, okay.
I love that. I have a hilarious story that I have actually told on the podcast before. So if people have listened to all the episodes, it's the second time I've told it. When I was very, very, very pregnant one time, I was at somebody's birthday party and it was at a wine bar. And I mean, like very, very pregnant, like enormously pregnant. And I went to the bar and I was like, hey, what do you have to drink that's like not wine at this wine bar birthday party? And he's like, oh, we have, cranberry juice and orange juice and whatever. So I had, and the but the only glassware they had was wine glasses. So he gives me like a giant goblet of cranberry juice with ice and a straw, and which was all fine and it was great. And I was waddling back to my friends, and I ran face to face with a super drunk young woman, and she was like, "You should not be drinking when you were pregnant." I was like, "Okay, calm down, just a moment. This is juice." I've always just loved that story. I'm like, who serves you red wine with ice and a straw? Moving on, this is juice. Go out and go enjoy your party. I'm fine. Baby's fine. We're all fine. So, but I do love that. It was huge. It would have been a bottle of wine. It was like that huge. So anyway, very good. All right. If you were to look back at your life in 2010, when you were drinking, comparing it to now, how has your life changed?
It's all internal change. I feel calm and content, peaceful. I feel not self-critical anymore. I'm not by any means perfect, but I don't beat myself up like I used to when I was drinking because I don't have all that stuff going on. I feel like now I see the world from the inside out. I used to always see the world as how the world perceived me. I was very self-conscious.
Yeah.
Now I don't feel that way anymore. Now I'm just doing me, and I'm not as concerned about what everybody else is thinking or doing without me. So it's kind of an inner peace. That's the number one difference.
So it's really a circle, though, because when you started drinking, it was because you were feeling social anxiety and trying to fit into the way you thought you wanted to be in fine circle. And then you got that. You achieved the peace and the calm through drinking. But then it's when you quit drinking, you're now actually calmer and happier with the you that is you.
Yeah, it's more authentic, and I don't have all the garbage that came with the drinking, the hangovers and the blackouts and the remorse and the risky behavior. Like, I never thought the words safe and predictable would sound attractive to me, but I think they're two of my best qualities now.
I love it. All right. Very, very good. All right. In a second, we're going to do the final questions. I want to make sure that we do give everybody who's watching and listening the information about your book, the name of your book. And this is your first book, I think. This is your first book.
Yes.
All right.
Yep.
Very good. Uncorked, a memoir of letting go and starting over. Right. And if you're watching, you can see it there. That is very exciting. It's available on Amazon. It's also on your website, which is maryalicestevens.com. And there's a link in the show notes wherever anybody's watching this in the description. The easiest way to get the links to find anything that's mentioned on the show for everybody who's watching and listening is to subscribe to my email community simply because that comes into your email box and you can click on it and it's easy peasy. So you do have a special offer for the listeners, which is that if somebody wants to look up your Instagram, which I'll put in the show notes also, and message you, the first person who does that, you will send them a copy of the book. They do have to be in the United States because postage is crazy expensive. But so that is a very generous offer. Thank you so much, Mary.
My pleasure. I hope somebody reaches out to me.
100%. All right. Are you ready for the final fun questions?
I'm ready.
Let's do it. All right. They're just for fun. Don't be pressured. All right. Very good. If you were invited to a last-minute potluck style event where you were asked to bring a dish to share, what is your go-to dish that you can whip up on short notice?
Asian-inspired hummus
Really? That
with
sounds
like
delicious.
sesame oil and soy sauce and hot chili oil and ginger.
Wow, that sounds great. I'm coming to your potluck. Okay,
Easy
very
and
good.
tasty.
I love that. All right. I love to ask this question for authors. Okay, do you read books or do you listen to them as audiobooks? And if so, which either way, can you share with us a recent book that you enjoyed?
I read on Kindle pretty much primarily because I got into that habit. Now I only read in bed, and usually my husband falls asleep first. So it's Kindle for me,
Me too.
lights out. And I just finished a book called America the Beautiful with a question mark at the end. This woman who was a researcher for the Stephen Colbert show wanted to go around to the national parks and collect junior ranger badges. She was 28. So it's memoir, and she's very funny. And I have this dream of taking the Great American Road Trip, but I can't tell if it's really going to be horrible or not. So I wanted to read her book and find out.
That is fantastic. So she's going and getting the Junior Ranger. I've been to most, I've done a lot of the parks and I have one of they call them passports just because it looks like a passport. I collect the stamps and the stickers for when I
Oh.
go to all the places. And I think it's fun. I think it's fun. Although sometimes before you plan a trip, I'm like ransacking the entire house trying to find this little book, like where I squirreled it away the last time. And it's like, where is it? And they're just like, what are you talking about? So there was it. All right. So America the Beautiful question mark. Great suggestion. All right. So everybody knows that life and stuff is getting more expensive. What is something that you buy for yourself, either like maybe a kitchen thing or maybe like a face cream? It doesn't matter kind of what it is, but something that you love so much that even when the price is going up, you're probably going to keep buying it for yourself.
Pedicures.
Ah, very nice.
They keep
Very.
getting more expensive.
Yeah. Everything is
But
getting more expensive.
it's such a treat to have painted toenails, and I'm terrible at doing it myself.
It is hard. It is very, very hard. All right, that's it. Mary Alice Stevens, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thank you, Amy. I had a great time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again. Please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.